Hello, and welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. Hey!
Hello. And before we start, just a couple of things. As ever, a big shout out to Dan and Nick at Smith & Weston. Those guys do the sound recording for the podcast. And look, everything you need to do, from VOs to sound stings to composing music, these guys are the bomb. They are absolutely great at what they do. They are great to work with. So please, for any of your sound needs, do consider Smith & Weston. And then secondly, I just want to quickly draw your attention to a brilliant new blog series. This is a series that draws parallels between the music business and advertising. It is full of insights, awesome little known music anecdotes, and very, very actionable tips. It covers people like Blur, Neil Young, Led Zeppelin, Amy Winehouse. It's kind of fascinating and really helpful at the same time. The series is called Wichita Ad Man. That's Wichita Ad Man. It's by my good friend, Mr. Simon Mannion, who actually happens to be one of the best creative leaders in the business. So please do check it out at wichitaadman.com. That's obviously wichitaadman.com. It's awesome. You won't regret it. Okay, now into our guest for today. I'm very excited because we have a very talented man, a very good friend of mine. I'm just going to give you a little bit of background. This is Nigel Lopez McBean. Nigel Lopez McBean is the co-founder and managing director at DBP Donut, based in LA. He was educated at Middlesex University in London, where he did a BA in social policy, and then Goldsmiths University of London, MA creative writing, and then he started his career at the BBC. He was a few years back the director of social marketing and creative services at Optus in Australia, in Sydney, Australia. And then he obviously moved over to LA to set up DBP Donut. Now, DBP Donut is the Duplass Brothers Emmy-nominated creative studio specializing in the creation of avant-garde, premium, short, and mid-form original content for digital platforms and networks, as well as unique audience-led content and films for brands. It was actually named one of Fast Company's 2019 most innovative companies in film and TV. They recently produced the first ever original scripted Disney series to premiere on YouTube. That was called Shook, which gained an Emmy nomination. And in 2020, DBP Donut was invited as an official selection at Sundance Film Festival for the series The Ride. Having said all of that, right now his main passion is political and social change. So we're going to get into that today. So a big warm welcome, Nigel Lopez McBean.
Hello, hello. It's good to be here.
Thanks, mate.
I can't believe it's taken us so long to do this. We should have done this ages ago.
Yeah, very true. Should have done this a year ago. But
you know what? The timing's right, because you've probably got a better version of me, a more interesting version of me now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's good timing, good context. Let's just set a bit of that context for everyone then. So how we always start these things is just with a bit of your background, like your family background, your childhood, like where your mum and dad are from, all that kind of stuff, please, Nigel.
Yeah, sure. So born in the Midlands, UK, city of Derby, which I'm still a proud Derby County supporter. Mum and dad were, you know, very much the typical Jamaican family. And by that I say kind of very conservative in their outlook, very wedded to the church. And, you know, my father was very, very invested in the community and in particular the West India community. So he spent an awful lot of time working within that community. And as a result, I was embedded into it too. So I learned a lot about what I know now from that time. It was kind of weird. But it was interesting because my father was over 50 when he had me. So,
wow.
Yeah, and I think that had a fairly massive effect on pretty much everything that happened to me post then. And I'll sort of quickly explain why. Because when you have a father at that stage that's so much older than you, there isn't a huge amount for, say, someone who's 10 and someone who's 65 to talk about. But I also had a brother who was 14 years older than me. So essentially, my family morphed into what I always jokingly call like an almost managing director and line manager type situation. where you know, the big stuff came from the top, but the actual execution and the people that, you know, had to keep me in check, that was my brother. So in many ways, I was kind of most influenced and brought up by my brother, who was at that stage living out of the home. He was living down in London and doing all manner of interesting, cool stuff, right? So, of course, I was regularly going down to London, sort of having the bonnet on this world of, like, amazing, fun, cool, interesting stuff, and then getting back on the train, going back to Derby, thinking to myself, I don't care how it happens, I have to get out of here and I have to get down to London. That's just non-negotiable.
Yeah, brilliant.
So that was really the sort of focus that I had for a long time. And then also, I think the other thing that was kind of fairly pivotal, had a really big effect on me, the fact that my father was basically the antithesis of a talker. So this is a man that would essentially chase whimsies, have ideas, and almost always execute on them. So it was quite crazy to watch. He would have an idea about something and he would always, always go and execute on it. That was kind of interesting. I always found that kind of fascinating as a sort of approach to life, which was, I think, it's quite handy for me to be attached to now. Just the idea that, you know, when you start talking about doing something, do you really actually want to go through with it or not? And I think that was a fairly sizable influence on me from quite an early age. I think the other thing, similar to yourself, Ant, that I think was probably really important is the whole business of growing up in that sort of second generation immigrant family, and also essentially living that dual life where, you know, your household is one thing, but you step outside the front door and it's a whole different thing. And kind of balancing that was always kind of quite complicated.
Yeah. I was just going to ask two sort of key questions on that then. It sounds like you're just getting to it. I suppose the two main questions I wanted to ask were, like, when did your parents actually come over from Jamaica was one. And then the other one was, like, so when you did step outside the door in Derby, was that quite a multiracial kind of multicultural area, like your school and your mates and stuff? Or was it fairly, were you fairly like kind of one of the only black families in the area?
Not at all. So mum and dad came over in 1956 originally to London, but my dad got the opportunity to work with Royal Mail, and also bizarrely, prior to moving to London, he was already a kind of Derby County fan because he listened to them win the FA Cup in 1946 against Charlton on BBC World Service and was like, that's my team. So, of course, when he got the opportunity to move up to this place that no person in their right mind would want to move to, he was quite energized to do that. In terms of the environment, it was like wildly, wildly multicultural. I mean, in many ways, my world kind of was like a Midlands version of probably your own from East London, and in that it was, there was your Sikh boys, your Muslim boys, you know, you had your Asian boys of different sorts, you know, you had your Black Caribbeans, African Caribbeans, Greeks, Turks, like everything you could possibly think of was in this sort of small 250,000 person town in the Midlands. And again, I think having those experiences and living close to a whole bunch of different people and kind of having a greater understanding and sort of empathy about how they live their lives has also been really, really helpful. It wasn't all sweet and light. It was, you know, a time when within that area there was still a lot of activity from, you know, the likes of the NAF, BNP, those kind of guys. That was still stuff that happened. And, you know, I used to have multiple routes home from nights out because I knew certain routes were more dangerous than others. So, you know, I look back on that time now and I'm just kind of pleased that there's hopefully a generation of people that won't have to sort of live that. That would be cool.
Yeah, that sounds like that Derby situation just sounds like an awesome, awesome upbringing. I was just going to say, I was just a little bit different in terms of, like, when I was growing up, when I was kind of from year dot to a young age growing up in East London, it was very much like you're describing there. You know, all my mates were kind of black, yeah. Asian, Irish, all of this stuff. It was amazing. But for me, I've probably told you this before, but when I was about 12 or maybe even 11, we moved out from East London, like in the way that East London works, like the minute your parents do kind of okay,
yeah,
everyone wants to move out to Essex and get the bigger house and the garden, like, oh, haven't we done well with the further away you've moved from East London, the better you've kind of you're seen to have done. So we moved out to Essex, so I went from that kind of upbringing, that background, to being the only brown kid in a school of 600. There were two of us and there was one black kid in the year below us, so yeah, a couple in an all-white school in an all-white area. And that was a little bit where my problem started, to be honest. When I was surrounded by, you know, all the different backgrounds and cultures and colors, I loved it. And when we kind of got to Essex and things were very different and very, very white and sort of more one-dimensional, it was more challenging, I must admit, which is why, like yourself, I was like, oh, my God, get me back to London as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
What? So moving into we talked about sort of uni. I mentioned about uni, Goldsmiths and so on. What was your sort of route into the world of work? Because there was creative writing that you studied there. Then you went to the BBC. How did that all come about?
So desperation more than anything else at the time. And also there was BBC was one of the few places where there was like an accepted track for persons like myself to get in, right? So I went there, had a couple of interviews, got a job in the the kids section, working on kids programming, and I absolutely loved it. Not necessarily the work itself, but I think learning about the business of creativity in somewhere like that was really, really cool. You got to see a lot of stuff. You got to see how things work. You got to see how things were executed. I was there during sort of 9/11, and I got to see, you know, how people react to crises and all of that stuff. So I also made a really great network of people who, you know, have sort of stayed in contact with me since then and gone our own kind of different paths. But it was almost like a perfect kind of place to actually really graduate into the world of work. And generally speaking, there's only kind of two routes with that. You either stay with an organization like that for your entire career, as people do, or you get to a certain stage and you go, right, I will kind of want to see what else is out there and also what it's like to work, outside the confines of like a public sector organization. So I sort of left there and then sort of went on this meandering path of working in lots of sort of PR agencies, comms agencies, some ad agencies, both in-house and freelance. But I was just kind of really sort of working out what it was that I really wanted to do and what really excited me. And I think over time it became quite apparent that like sort of the internet and online and all of that was kind of technology sort of excited me. And then I sort of ended up kind of by accident, in all honesty, moving to Australia. And that was exactly the same time that, you know, the Twitters and the Facebook and the whole social media thing started to pop off, literally about a year after I was there. And I just thought to myself, this is something I kind of feel like I understand quite well and could do interesting things with. And then really kind of stayed on that path for quite a long time. And it was sort of fascinating to see over time how big and influential the whole social media thing became, to the point where we are now. It's actually quite wild if you sort of think about it. It's come full circle to the point where as somebody that kind of was a professional in that world and lived that world intensely for a long time, you know, I don't personally use Facebook or Instagram anymore because I have such huge personal issues with, you know, the way that information has been disseminated on those platforms and the effect it has directly on persons like myself. So, you know, it's becoming increasingly hard if you are I think it's very hard if you're a person of color to really sit down and go, why are we still using these platforms? All they do is hurt us. So it's been an interesting journey, and the journey that kind of led to hear in some ways kind of feels, I'll speak about this quite a lot with my wife, actually. It almost feels like I was sort of preordained or destined to be here, because I arrived, what was it, 2 weeks before the 2016 election, which is possibly the worst timing in the history of mankind.
Mm.
And so it's one thing moving from Sydney to LA. That's a big move. Culturally, there's lots of different things going on. But it's a whole other thing when you basically move to this new environment, kind of expecting one thing, and you get there and the bait and switch is so huge, and the effect of that, the effect of that event is just culturally so massive. So, I mean, in many ways, we had to do a lot of like rethinking about what this new world we were in meant and how what it was going to mean for us. So it was, it's been a very, very crazy time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I absolutely want to sort of dive right into that. And obviously the Black Lives Matter, like where you've gone from that election process to where we are today, the Black Lives Matter movement and all that stuff. Before we get there, though, just two things. First, two questions. Firstly, I want to just pick you up on and ask you just a bit more about the Facebook stuff, because you were just saying, you know, you don't use that stuff, you know, the way they hurt us. Can you just kind of expand a bit more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. As someone worked very closely and intensely on those platforms for a really long time, you know, I kind of know the problems with them. I know, you know, the whole business of clustering information in ways in which people are effectively given completely false senses of reality. And I just think that we are now at a stage where there is so much hurt, so much pain, so much disrespect, so much dangerous information that's been delivered via those platforms, that we've really got to take a step back and have a think about what it is we're actually doing. I mean, I think it's quite exciting now that so many brands are beginning to go, actually, do you know what? I'm not comfortable placing my money here anymore, because we're beginning to see the net effect of what happens when you know, people are delivered content in such a way that kind of makes them feel bad. Why would you ever want to have your brand wrapped around any of that? So that's great. And also similar with that, you know, in most situations, money talks. And as soon as there's any kind of financial penalty on an organization like Facebook around this stuff, I think you're going to start to see change fairly quickly. But it's been interesting, like from a sort of social media perspective, in that I sort of focus on Twitter largely because I just feel that is creatively there's so much amazing stuff going on there. And I have an absolute total obsession with Black Twitter, which I think is just culturally amazing. It's something I was kind of plugged into when I was in Australia, but it's different when you're actually here in real time. And just the humor, the warmth, the empathy, the education, the creativity, in many ways, it feels to me like social media at its absolute best. And I think it's going to ultimately provide a sort of quite a long-term engine for the Black Lives Matters movement. This isn't something that's going away anytime soon for a ton of different reasons, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting what you're saying about the Facebook thing, because like clearly that trickle of brands sort of walking away now, sort of saying that's enough, is becoming more of a stream of brands walking away. And that's got to, like you say, because of the money situation, that's got to drive fairly major change.
Yeah, you'd hope. We shall see.
And then just before we move on, just one other thing. I just wanted to almost approach this in a slightly chronological order. So there was that moment with the in your career with the position at Facebook where you were the director at Facebook at Optus, where you were the director of social marketing and creative services. And we worked quite closely together at that point. I wanted to just cover I just wanted to cover one particular moment in that. You were I was at M&C Saatchi at that point, and we were doing some ads and various stuff for Optus. You were the man behind the Ricky Gervais campaign. I guess you could call it a social media campaign.
That's essentially what it was, and it kind of morphed into a bunch of other stuff. That was really I think we just learned a lot about power of entertainment, You know, we're talking about something that was, you know, relatively simple, really, really well executed and universally funny, sort of delivered aggressively through newsfeed. And I think I just kind of came away from that thinking, you can have really big, interesting moments and really change the way people think if you organize things in the right way. So it really kind of just sort of made me go, do you know what? I have a certain amount of credibility now. This has been really interesting, but what can we kind of do next? And I was sort of very lucky in that in Charlie Lee, who was the creative on that work, we both had a lot of sort of personal and professional sort of synergies around how we saw the world and what we liked and what we kind of wanted to do next. And that was really the sort of genesis of the whole donut thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, as you'll know, it's really difficult in this world to try and find people that you can work closely with, collaborate with, who are as passionate about what you want to do as they are. So I think buddying up with Charlie to start Donut was pretty pivotal to this whole thing. And it was interesting because you have to be fairly crazy to basically pick up your family and move to LA to essentially chase a dream, right? Because ultimately, when you start a business, you've got absolutely no idea whether it's going to work out or not. So it's an enormous leap of faith. And when you do that, you need people around you that also have that positive outlook that you know are going to be in the trenches with you. And as you all know, those people aren't easiest to find. Yeah, and I feel I was very lucky in that, you know, I might me and Charlie struck up a friendship and a partnership. And but we also very strangely had a personal thing that we're basically bonded by. And that was the fact that both of our fathers died in the same year.
Right, okay.
And when something like that happens to you, there's just a world of stuff that you understand and the change in your mindset that is very helpful when you start a business, or I think go into any situation in which you're going to have to learn and take some risks. So I think though all of those things together created an environment where you essentially had two guys who were, you know, very happy to go over to the US and see what happened.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. And that, that sort of partnership, yourself and Charlie, that sort of had its genesis in that campaign, and I'm sure some other work that you guys did. That's amazing. I mean, just going back to that Ricky Gervais campaign, just to remind anyone who sort of doesn't remember or might need the memory jogging, this was the piece with Ricky Gervais where he kind of did a piece to camera saying, look, Optus have given me a bunch of money to talk about Optus. Don't even know who Optus are. I've spent the money. Will this do? Kind of thing. And, mate, I remember you and I and a bunch of people were in, a bunch of Optus people were, and M&C people were in San Francisco on a sort of
YouTube, weren't we?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember there was a bit of a sense among the Optus team of, will this work? Is this mental? Or, you know, is this going to, you know, be a complete disaster? And then every day at the end, you know, at dinner or sort of throughout the day, you'd be getting updates going, mate, million views,
yeah,
5 million views, 10 million. It was like, fuck, this is really kicking off. This is really going. I suppose what I wanted to ask was, Did you always know that was going to be super successful?
100%. It was the most surefire thing in the history of surefire things. Mm. I mean, like anyone who'd spent any time on social media, in all honesty, could have told you that creative would have done really well, just purely based out of the respect for the audience. I mean, and also, I think it's a lot to do with the environment of which it was dropped within, because there was just something slightly anarchic and very Australian about that.
Mm. It's
kind of the ultimate piss take. And I think just that, the respect for the audience and people respect, like, oh my God, that happened. That couldn't have been easy to pull off. And people get that. And even it's crazy, like even over here to this day, I still have people like, oh, I love that. Or people like reference it and will go, Charlie and I will go, oh, yeah, we kind of did that. And people are like, oh, my God. So, yeah, it's crazy. It's
but it was amazing.
It was a really fun time and just a fantastic platform for a bunch of other stuff that we managed to do, which is great.
Yeah. So, and then you've kind of talked about how, yeah, that then sort of became a springboard into moving to LA, starting up DBP Donuts at Donut. How's that, but you talked about sort of the genesis, but how's it been for the last few years? How's the agency?
Yeah, it's been phenomenal. It's been really phenomenal. We've had some amazing work. We've worked with amazing clients. I kind of feel like we've been on a, really aggressive sort of accelerated learning scheme about not only the business of creativity within the entertainment industry, but also, just culture and just understanding like how culture affects creativity. Because the thing that is so difficult to navigate in the US is in many ways the constant change. There's a constant change. There's constant different conversations. Something that was completely unimportant yesterday can be, you know, completely newsworthy and change the whole position of something tomorrow. So being here and kind of understanding and seeing that has been like massively beneficial. And we've kind of, you know, managed to cut our own pathway through all of this by, you know, having a lean team, focusing on very much creative first, finding the best possible people to work with, being very choosy about the kind of work that we do, trying to find the right partners who kind of get what we do. And trying to find people we can kind of work with in a genuinely collaborative way, because that's kind of the kind of part of what we do. I mean, we're a business whose spiritual guides are essentially two brothers. So that as a basis for collaboration. I mean, they wrote a book about it last year. So that as a basis for collaboration means it's kind of like super important to it.
Can you just talk about that a bit more? Just because I just wanted to say, like, obviously, Donut, it's not an ad agency, is
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely not.
Tell us about sort of a bit about the brothers and how it works.
Yeah, sure. So we're a creative studio specialized. We just make stuff that's interesting to us, right? And things that we think we can bring a really different empathy, warmth, or positioning to. So we don't do everything. I think that's very important to say, but we do work in which we can, you know, fully invest ourselves. I think the situation with Mark and Jay is basically best explained as, and I joke about this, but I think they run probably the best creative mentoring scheme you could ever imagine. and they probably don't even realize it, but given the success of the people that have gone through it, it kind of tells you they're onto something big. And having been through it myself, you are essentially given a lot of latitude, a lot of freedom to go out and do certain things. But of course, you know, when you're working in at the intersection of both kind of brand and Hollywood, there's a kind of whole world of machinations that you kind of need to work around. And what they are phenomenal at doing is kind of educating and arming you on how to deal with that. Because I think, aside from being unbelievable creatives and really, really genuine, beautiful, warm people, I think the thing that that the Duper Brothers, Mark and Jay, are so amazing at is just they are probably the best creative businessmen I've ever been anywhere near. Just their understanding of what works, what doesn't, how to move around this industry, how to choose the right work, how to attach yourself to the right things, and just basically set yourself up in a way in which the industry works for you. You sort of don't work for it, which is an incredibly difficult thing to pull off, but they have. And the knowledge share around that is so valuable to us as a business, just in terms of, you know, being able to not only tap into their creativity, but also tap into the creative minds of the, you know, the hundreds of people that they know in their network, who might not necessarily have, you know, ever really had any experience working with, you know, brands or platforms or any of that sort of stuff. So it's just been very helpful from a number of different standpoints to you know, basically have them in our business and have them backing us.
Yeah. I mean, from the outside looking in, the Duplass brothers, they really do seem to have kind of carved their own path and gained that kind of sense of autonomy, creative autonomy. And that seems to have been sort of handed down to Donut as well, the autonomy that you guys have got in the different projects that you do.
And it's great that you talk about handing it down, because I think one of the things that I think I'm most grateful for is the fact, you know, we're working with amazing creators that aren't sort of precious about, you know, handing down that information, passing it on. This is what you do, this is what you don't, this is kind of what you need to lean into, stay away from that, that's going to be a bit of a problem. All of those kind of things, you know, not everyone shares. So, you know, having that information is fantastic. And also, I kind of now feel that I'm at a place where I kind of need to be doing more sharing of that information to people myself.
Yeah.
So, which will probably take us on to like the next topic, right?
Yeah. Let's do that. I mean, I suppose the way I was going to move on was to say, look, Donut is obviously a partly black-owned business.
Do you know what? It's crazy. It's crazy you say that, because Obviously I'm in it, but I don't sit around thinking about my business as being a black-owned business. It's only recently that people have started to referring to Donut as that, and that's been kind of like, that's been super interesting for me in lots of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about it. How has it felt? How has it been, running Donut, you know, during these times, having people say things like that, and just the general sort of vibe in LA and the stuff that's going on with the protests?
On a personal level, it's been pretty heartbreaking to watch. I mean, I've seen a bunch of stuff, and I've heard about stuff that, you know, I've always knew existed, but to see it so... to basically see it in your Twitter feed and it being so visceral, is you can't not be affected by that. And also, you know, I'm on the one hand, I'm an insider and an outsider, because on the one hand I'm black, but on the other side I'm not an African American. So I'm having to do a lot of learning about a lot of history that, you know, that wasn't taught to me in schools. And obviously, because I'm not an American, I've never really would have looked for. So often things are happening at the moment, I'm like, oh, what does that actually mean? I've got to go off and read about it. And it's weird, because you sort of start to build a picture of the way of the sort of pain, disrespect and danger that black communities face here, that just gets worse and worse. So the more you read, the more you learn, the worse it gets. And in many ways, what I've kind of seen and experienced has sort of personally changed. It sort of changed the way I look at my own past, and sort of I can imagine it's quite similar to yourself, in that there's a whole bunch of stuff that was accepted as a given when I was a kid that I'm just kind of, that's unacceptable to a lot of young people now. And I really love that. I think that's very special. And I just think that, particularly with the Black Lives Matters movement at the moment, this isn't one that's going away. This one's different. This one isn't going to be hashtag of the week or sort of performative social post of the month. I think this one is going to lead to, I don't know the scale of the change, but I do know and feel very confident based on lots of conversations that are happening in my universe with like black executives and black creators and stuff. Things are going to change. There's power moves being made behind the scenes that people might not be aware of, but it's going to have to. There's no way around it. I mean, I think, and I'll just use this as an example because it's the game that you're in at, is that I've found the response from the advertising industry fairly underwhelming, but I kind of knew that there were systemic problems within that industry a good couple of years ago, and I'll explain quickly why. So about 18 months, 2 years ago, there was a agency, I can't remember which one it was, but it's a major agency with offices in London and New York, who were set a challenge by their, I think it was a technology client, to basically change the way their teams looked. So it was like, if you want to continue working on our business, you need to change. Creative team needs to be, you know, 50% female. You need to be bringing in more diversity, more Black creatives, more Latinx creatives, all of that. Yeah. I think they gave them a year to do it, with the idea being that they would go back to Advertising Week in New York the year after, then sit on a panel and explain your results. So I kind of heard this and I thought it was a really cool way to affect change in that world. And it was kind of interesting that it was led by a client. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, well, it's led by a client, so there's no way it's not going to happen. And then I think the agency in question presented at Adweek, and they'd managed to meet the female creative quota. But I think they'd failed on every other measure. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't ever remember a situation where a major advertising agency or any creative business would be happy sitting on a stage telling the rest of the industry about its failure. Right? And I just thought to myself, employing more Black people in creative industries is the easiest and simplest creative challenge I can think of, right? And if you are a business that has your spiritual homes or offices in London and New York, I can kind of only conclude that you don't want to employ Black people, because there's no excuse for, if your business is in London and New York, two of the most dynamic cities for Black culture and Black talent, if you can't find them, I don't believe you're looking, because quite frankly, I could solve that problem in a month. So that to me kind of showed the sort of scale of the problem and just how systemic it is. I mean, it's, agencies aren't known for failure. They're not known for advertising failure. They're not known for not executing. You ask them to do anything, they will go out and do their very best to get it done. That's what they do, and they do it brilliantly. Yeah. But when it comes to this, there's some sort of problem which I can't fathom. And as I say, the only conclusion I can draw based on the evidence I'm seeing in front of my eyes is, do they really want to employ Black people? That's the question I'd like answered. Because,
well, that was the thing you were talking about there was a couple of years ago. Are you seeing any change? Are you seeing any improvement over the last couple of years, or do you think it's just flatlined?
It's just flatlined. I think it's slightly better now. I love the approach that the two Black creatives who led the 600 and Rising letter took. I think it's Bennett D. Bennett and Nathan Young.
Yeah.
And I love the approach that they've taken to this problem, because it's, what they've done is like really strategic. Rather than jump on a social media thing or whatever, they've actually, you know, built a company, they've built a thing, they've garnered power, they've got names, they're communicating with large groups of people, and they've just basically built this thing that is not going to go away. And it's going to get to a stage where, if change doesn't happen, it's going to become hugely embarrassing for a lot of people. And I think they've seen that the door is slightly ajar. And I think they've taken their opportunity to kind of not only call out the holding companies, but just basically hold the industry to account and say, hey, you're saying you can't find Black talent. Well, here's a document with 1,000 names. I think that's very clever. And I have very little doubt that those guys will succeed in lots of different ways.
No, it does seem to be kind of growing. I love the way it's called 600 and Rising, and it seems to be actually rising by the day, which is awesome. It seems to be also quite they're just getting the balance just right between sort of collaboration with agencies and sort of and versus shaming, because I feel like they're sort of saying to agencies, look, here's the olive branch, this is what we're asking you to do. We're kind of not asking now, we're sort of demanding, to be honest, but it just needs to get done, but we're giving you a chance to do it, and, you know, come on board and help us do this stuff.
It's passive aggressive in the best possible way. And I think it'll work. I mean, there's a There's a guy that I follow on Twitter called Derek Walker, who's a founder of...
I follow Derek Walker as well, yeah.
He's phenomenal. I just think he's industry Yoda. But I think he tweeted out something the other day which really did affect me, actually. I think he was saying that larger agencies in Atlanta are struggling to find or struggle to find black talent or don't have enough black talent in the house. And as someone that went to Atlanta a zillion times on the way to various trips to Jamaica, I mean, the place is what, 30, 40% black?
Mm.
So the idea that black talent, black creatives aren't being employed in creative agency or creative businesses in Atlanta just sort of blew my mind. And that kind of just really tells you, it really gave me pause, and it was like, that's the scale of the problem. It's huge.
Yeah.
Particularly when, as we know, you know, those same agencies and are happy to use elements of black culture, lean into black culture, use, you know, amazing black talent and all of that. The idea that in somewhere like Atlanta, you know, that black talent wouldn't be the engine for that creativity is kind of, yeah, that's a difficult one for me to really accept.
I saw one on Twitter recently, which I don't know if this is kind of an age-old one or I'd just seen it, but it was, they want our rhythm, but they don't want our blues. So, they want to use kind of our culture and our, you know, all our music and all of this great sports stuff, but they don't want to hear about, you know, the other side
that,
of things.
That sounds about right, yeah. But, as I say, I love what those guys have done. The way they've gone about it, I think, is super clever, really sustainable, and I think they're the exact sort of people you need kind of leading this thing.
Yeah, and then just keeping on with what those guys are doing, the 600 and rising thing, you've talked a bit about representation and like the ridiculously low amounts of black creatives in the industry. The other side of what they're doing is also when there are black creatives in the industry, the treatment of those people, the opportunity those people are given to, you know, to have chances on briefs, to work on things, to be in front of clients and so on. What have your experiences of that been kind of personally and what you've seen in the industry of the way people are treated?
I think, to be honest, I live in a bit of a bubble being in the sort of having one foot in the sort of independent film world, one foot in kind of like the Hollywood world and also brands as well. And what I have seen is basically probably the absolute reverse of what would happen in most agencies in that there is an expectation that people have to fit into any sort of overarching culture. And again, it's a very important thing for us at Donut is that culturally, all we really want from you is your excellence, your energy, and to be a good person. Just like for the time you're working with us, have respect for the people you work with, right? Anything outside of that, I'm not going to demand of you, right? And I think that is the opposite approach to a lot of agencies, I think, where they have this overarching culture that they want people to fit into. But ultimately what happens is you end up just employing various looking versions of yourself. And does that really take you where you need to go? Probably not. I can definitely say from the experiences we've had that, you know, the magic happens and the best stuff happens when you get the most diverse teams together. That's like a fact. There's nothing to discuss there. Which is also why I'm kind of confused again why businesses that only sell creativity, like creativity and people is what they sell, simply doesn't want to employ people that are going to give them an alternative or different view on stuff. That just doesn't really, because the whole purpose of creativity is to think differently. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who are creatively minded. And just in the way that they grew up and lived their life, they think differently. I mean, one of the things I always say to people, particularly anyone working in an industry doing anything where they might feel that they are different to the most of the people around them, the one thing that you have, particularly as an immigrant kid, is you have this huge advantage because you have your perspective. And your perspective is a very, very different one from the majority of the people around you. And the cheat code on all of this is that most of the people around you don't realize that you have a different perspective, because a huge number of people kind of think everybody thinks the same way as them. Right? So that perspective is really, to my mind, your kind of keys to the castle. And that's kind of what I've, that's what I've always sort of tried to lean into, because I think that's the beauty of creative teams, or really good, successful creative teams and teams that are going to succeed in the future. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a combination of that diversity. It's going to be about, you know, respect for other people's opinions. And if you start that, I mean, you can only go to sort of better and more interesting places.
Yeah. And then just related to that, I just wanted to chat a bit about, there's two ends of this. There's the more senior end that you're obviously playing at, but then there is the other end of things where people get into the industry, into the creative industries. And I was thinking, I'm always banging on about Public Enemy on this, because I'm just a
same
Public Enemy, always have been. Yeah.
Same.
That thing that they once said, Elvis was a hero to most, but he didn't mean shit to me. Most of my heroes don't appear on those stamps.
Yeah,
that always, I've been thinking about that recently and thinking, when your heroes don't appear on the stamps, that says to you, I'm not, this culture is not for me. And I think it must be hard for young people coming into the industry when they don't see lots and lots of black and brown and different you know, senior figures that look like them, and kind of, you know, the whole thing about you can't be what you can't see. I think it really puts off young people when they don't see those role models.
Very much so, like, to a crazy degree. I mean, number one, for a start, get people in the industry, you know, early and pay them. I mean, the sheer number of people who have to get into the industry and not be paid is just criminal. There's that, but also, I mean, it's interesting from my perspective, because I've now realized, probably during this pandemic, that I have a sort of bigger responsibility now. It's not just about me. And I kind of came to that realization as a result of the numerous black creatives and people in the industry who've like hit me up on Twitter or LinkedIn, and they're like, hey, and blah, 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 and they'll ask me questions, and I'm like, oh, okay. Now people are actually coming to me, and they're like, respect. I'm someone whose opinion they seek or respect. That's really sort of flicked a switch in my mind and gone, right, how are we going to sort of address this and lean into this and be as helpful as we can? Because we've always been very, very, I would almost say obsessive about how our creative work looks. It's very diverse, and you'll notice if you've gone outside, there's a ton of black faces there. We've always leaned into work that is not only diverse, but at its heart is kind of warm and that people can connect with. But that's one thing. But then you've got to start thinking about the way in which you build your organization for the future, the kind of people that you need, want, who are going to take you where you need to go. And there's a whole ton of stuff that's rolling around in my head that hopefully, if everything works out well, at the end of this pandemic, we'll be able to execute on and actually start delivering some kind of substantive change and help to all of these black creatives who, you know, are struggling to find work or struggling to find the right opportunities. Because quite frankly, there's so much talent out there that it's kind of utterly criminal that some of these people just, you know, have effectively floundered because no one's wanted to employ them. It's kind of mad.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen books of work, and I've just gone, I don't understand how it's possible for this person to be unemployed. Right, or have been unemployed for like the last 18 months or whatever. So again, on a personal level, it's a really, I'm still struggling to kind of really articulate and sort of gather my feelings about the whole thing, because it's just so raw at the moment. It really is. On the upside, I am seeing a ton of stuff that I never thought I would see in my lifetime. And it was a pretty amazing thing when I actually went to a Black Lives Matters protest in Highland Park, which I think you've been to, Ant, right?
It was
really heartening to see just the hordes of people there and the diversity of the people and just how passionate and how angry they were about what they'd seen. And that really kind of affected me. And I was like, wow, this is not something I've seen before. And then added to that, I mean, the whole thing was sort of genuinely dystopian, because I remember at the time thinking to myself, I'm going to protest with a bunch of other people I've never met in my life in the middle of a global pandemic in Northeast LA. And is this protesting going to get me sick? And I'm going to bring that back to my family who have respiratory issues. So it was literally a moment where I'm thinking to myself, that whole business about being prepared to die or whatever as a result of protest. I was genuinely feeling that. So it's been a wild time.
I think you mentioned to me when we were chatting a little while after that you walked out of your, I don't know if it was at the protest, but you walked out of your door one day and like kind of an old 80-year-old Asian lady sort of gave from across the road, gave you a Black Power salute.
There's two things that have happened that have just been completely weird. What one was getting the Black Power salute from some elderly Asian ladies, but that was certainly something that wasn't happening like 3 months ago. And then something that's not only happened to me, but happened to a number of other people I know of, is I was out jogging in my local area a few weeks ago, and I jogged past a sort of middle-aged white couple, and I was applauded.
Wow.
They started clapping. And it was really odd, because I didn't know whether that was... I didn't know what that action really meant. I didn't... I was like, am I being trolled? Like what, or was that just generally, oh, I feel warmth because I've seen a Black person running safely through the streets. Either way, it was kind of weird. And I just thought to myself, if I'm getting applauded for safely running through the streets of my own area, you can start thinking quite weird things about that.
Yeah, that's. I'm not sure how I feel about that. It's quite odd, isn't it?
It was very odd, and it's sort of stayed with me for like a couple of weeks now. But that's the crazy time we're in. Like, really screwy things are happening, and I think it's not only a Black issue. I think there's a huge number of people who aren't Black who are really struggling to understand what they feel about this, and also. I think there's again, accelerated learning for a lot of people. A lot of people are seeing things that they've never seen before, they've never heard before, they didn't realize actually even went on. I mean, I've had numerous conversations with people who are absolutely astonished that these things go on, that you know, you can experience this hate, this racism, this anger, this danger. They are genuinely astonished. And then the thing that's crazy for me is I'm astonished that they're astonished. I think we're in this place where everyone's going to have to come up to speed in what's going on and accept what's going on and accept change, because ultimately it's not about, you know, it's not about just Black people. It's about this, these things shouldn't be happening in any kind of like safe, sane society. It's just kind of weird, you know?
Yeah. I mean, just going back to that jogging thing for a bit, or just how we're all going to get on, I just wanted to ask a question. This might be a bit sort of philosophical, but I've had this experience in my life where when I was growing up, one of my, strangely as well as Public Enemy, one of my sort of my heroes and my biggest influences have been the Smiths, the band the Smiths, and Morrissey, the guys from Manchester. Yeah. And I kind of hero worship those guys. Their songs kind of got me through, you know, posters on the walls, you know, all of those things. And then over the last 10 years, it's been this strange experience where the main guy, Morrissey, has just kind of evolved or revealed himself to be this complete dick and, you know, more and more and more sort of racist. There's no other way of putting it. Yeah, anyway, totally. He kind of seemed to sort of recently, about a year ago, just kind of put all of those, the thoughts that he'd been having into one line that just really, made me think. And he just said this thing where someone had questioned him about whether he was a racist or not, Morrissey. And he just said, well, look, ultimately, everyone prefers hanging out with their own race. That's just the bottom line. And I kind of fundamentally just didn't agree with that. But yeah. I don't know, maybe he's got a point. I'm not sure. What do you think?
I think it all depends on, again, your own personal perspective in your own world. I mean, people like you and myself, we didn't grow up in that world. I grew up in a world of diversity. That's entirely normal to me. Even in the house I'm sat in now, there's me, a white woman from New Zealand, and a child called James who's half black and half white. One of us was born in the UK, one of us was born in New Zealand, and one of us was born in Australia. If that's the basis for your world, when Morrissey says something like that, you just kind of laugh. And, you know, it's just like, no, not
doesn't
really.
Compute.
It doesn't compute. But at the same time, that is reality for a lot of people. I mean, it's been interesting seeing the disconnect in certain people throughout this whole Black Lives Matter period, where people have wanted to react and they've wanted to sort of show they're an ally. And there's been a whole, almost like a whole social media performative thing about, let's throw something up, let's say how we feel, let's show some support.
Yeah.
And then I obviously know some of those people and I know how undiverse their worlds are. Right. Mm. So it's a very strange one. So
how did you feel about that? How have you felt about that? The whole, you know, the black squares thing and all that, because in the last one we got into one with Faustina and she was very, very angry about the fact that people that didn't live in a diverse world and weren't doing the work or doing anything really to reach out to, you know, diverse communities were suddenly throwing up these Instagram squares.
I thought the Instagram square thing was kind of madness because you just basically blacked out the message. It was sort of ultimately meaningless. I'm just kind of at the stage now where I just want people to, I'm not really listening to what people say anymore. I'm more interested in what they're going to do. I think that's ultimately where it's got to go to, because I think the other thing that's kind of irritating and annoying at the moment is how the aims of Black Lives Matter has been sort of pushed into this weird culture war that nobody ever asked for. So, you know, now you've got this situation where, for example, you've got certain entertainment companies in America who are now removing content that they feel might be problematic, that might be 25, 30 years old, which the world is a different place. But removing that content and sort of trying to align it to, because of Black Lives, we're kind of removing it. It's like there's not a single black person on the planet that asked for episode whatever of the Golden Girls to be removed from, you know, whatever platform it is, right? And it's very dangerous to kind of start to confuse all of this kind of like cultural stuff with the actual problem in hand. And the problem is we need to employ more black people in positions, not only positions of power, but any kind of position of influence across a stack of industries. It has to change. So it's kind of interesting to me that so much energy can be placed on trying to do this performative stuff. Leave that alone. Focus the energy on what changes you're actually planning to make. And you start to see, I mean, Netflix recently, they put together a $100 million fund to run through black-owned and black-funded banks, right? That's doing something, right?
That's amazing, yeah.
Right. Tick, right? Done something. It doesn't need to be on that scale, but just saying what it is you're going to do, I think, is powerful and important. The time for hashtag of the month, I kind of feel, is sort of over.
Yeah, I hear you. And what about not just what you're going to do out there in the world, though, but what people are doing in their own lives? I mean, I'm thinking about education, for example. People that just seem to be far more interested in educating themselves a bit more, in kind Absolutely. Of finding out before they open their mouths, which must be surely a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, it's the one thing I think has been really good. It's actually got it's got a ton of people I know kind of inspire them to talk more openly about race and their feelings and situations they've seen And that's, you know, I've heard some like real mea culpas about people have, should have said something in a moment or whatever, but this is all good. I think it's all great that people are beginning to just sort of think. Just that's all you need to do. Just think, right?
Yeah.
If you actually start thinking about what it is you're doing and saying, I mean, we kind of live in this crazy world where, you know, everyone wants to react and talk, but like sort of sometimes listening and thinking and kind of understanding is where it's at, because, you know, black communities are basically saying en masse in a very articulate way, these are the problems, these are the things we're facing, these are the things we need to change. It has to change. What are you going to do? So we wait, we watch, we see. Luckily, as I say, I think the timing of this is interesting because there's enough people who are, you know, struggling or down or have suddenly basically seen the world in a very different way, who now go, actually, I've got the energy for this. This is all wrong and it needs to change. And it will. I have no doubts that it won't.
Yeah. I mean, the education, the learning thing I found fascinating. Like, I've just been reading that that book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. And the fact, like, it was just interesting, sort of tying back to something you said before, because you're obviously an English guy in America.
Yeah.
And she starts that book by saying, look, she grows up black in East London. And she says, yeah, look, I don't really get taught about our history, about black history when she was growing up. She's kind of about our vintage. But she says, what we knew about the history of black people was more an American history, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she just, her and her friends didn't even know there was any such thing as, you know, a history of slavery, black slavery in the UK, you know, all these slave ports in Liverpool and Bristol. Crazy, and so on. Yeah, it's just like, wow. And she starts reading into it and going, oh my God, this is what happened in this country, as in the UK. It's not something that was miles away that was going on in America. This country, England, had a massive hand in this horrendous stuff. And I didn't know, you know, and now I know.
Absolutely. And it was like, you know, I remember what the education system was like then. I think it was like Magna Carta, World War One, World War Two, present day. That was kind of what they told you. And so, yeah, there's a huge number of people kind of like suddenly go, oh, I need to read that. Even myself, I've been reading Notes of a Native Son from James Baldwin, and it's just crazy how far ahead of time, you know, he was as a writer and thinker. It's kind of mad. But the Black British thing's really interesting because my wife and I, we often joke about this thing called the Black Window, right? Which we experience in America. And the Black Window is basically where I'm placed into a situation where I inadvertently see two different outcomes. And I'll give you an example. So I can be in, say, Beverly Hills, and I will walk into a store in Beverly Hills. And the moment I walk into the store, you can basically feel the tension. You can feel the person behind the counter sort of like, oh, what's going on? Who's this guy? I've got this black guy in my shop. Oh my God. Da, 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 da. And then I will say, hi or hello. And literally the entire atmosphere and the way I'm perceived and received by that person completely changes. It's turned on its head. And
why? Your accent.
Yeah. So it's kind of heartbreaking to sort of know that, because then I leave the shop and I go, well, if I was African American, that would have been a whole different experience, right?
Yeah.
You know, I walked in the shop, the woman perceived me as being an African American person that she didn't like. I spoke, I had a British accent, all of a sudden that's all different. And, you know, she wants to find out how long I've been here, what I'm doing, whether she can help me. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of mad.
It's heartbreaking. It's kind of offensive.
It really is. And It's weird because those experiences have really sort of brought me a lot closer to like that sort of African American experience, and it's like wow, I get it now. And then that all those microaggressions and all that stuff that has been spoken about for years that has always felt very kind of US in context. Now I'm here and I actually see it in the raw. It's a crazy, crazy thing to see. And I now have a really good understanding of how difficult it would be to sort of live in this country, having to live your whole life in this country, having to deal with that. That would be exhausting to a point of madness.
Yeah. And mate, Nigel, we're gonna wrap up. We're gonna start to wrap up. But we always end these podcasts on I don't know, like a little lesson or a quote or like a little bit of inspiration or a story from your career or your life. Is there anything you can leave us with? Any kind of little observation that you've made that could be inspiring to the people listening?
Generally speaking, in my head, this is what I think is probably a mental trick that I've employed. But it was actually came from my dad. But he always used to say the people around you are more scared than you are. And I never really knew, I never really knew what that meant. And then I've been in multiple situations now where it's all made sense, because you know everyone suffers with, like, you know, most people suffer with some sort of imposter syndrome or whatever. You get to a certain state, you go, "Oh, why me?" But once you realize that there's generally people around you that suffer that even more than you do, that's kind of interesting, and it stops you ever feeling sort of nervous and afraid to kind of go for what you want.
Yeah, love it.
And the other thing I would probably say is I'm a big fan of sort of chasing whimsies that won't sort of mentally leave you. So many people have got that idea or something in their head, then they might have had it for years. If it won't leave you, it's probably worth doing something about. And that was kind of the basis of how we all ended up here. And as someone that did actually take the time and make the effort to basically chase something, I can highly, highly recommend it, because as you know yourself, it's just so completely rewarding when it goes, when it even goes half right.
Yeah. And also, mate, God, you do not want to be in that situation where you've not scratched that itch, or you've not chased that whimsy, so to speak, and it's too late. You know, geez, I don't want to be looking back thinking, why didn't I do that? Hey, mate, I just want to, we do normally end there. I just want to end with one more bonus, a little bonus round. We are obviously both big boxing fans. Partly where our friendship kind of started in talking about boxing. So I just want to have a little bonus round. Tyson Fury versus Anthony Joshua. Is it going to happen? And if it does happen, who's going to win?
I think it will happen. There's too much money for it not to happen. And they'll probably do it a couple of times. When it will happen, I don't know. If it happened twice, I think Fury wins the first one. And then I couldn't tell you what happens the second. But for me, Fury is just too good at the moment. He's just what he's morphed himself into. This is just that classic, the man that comes back from the dead is always just super dangerous. You know, he's had his mental health problems, he blew up, he's on drugs, he was out, he was down, he was never going to fight again. And then you have to respect the way he's pulled himself up from like the depths of hell to become WBC heavyweight champion of the world. It's kind of crazy. There's no human being who would have predicted that he would be where he is now 2 years ago.
Yeah, amazing story. But having said that, AJ obviously did get beaten by the Mexican lad and, you know, has sort of dragged himself back up a little bit, maybe not, you know, from as far.
Absolutely. Purely from a boxing perspective, I just think Fury is just too talented, too skilled. And, you know, what he managed to do to Wilder in the last fight was just, pretty crazy to watch. I would say it's one of the most shocking performances I've ever seen, because I didn't know that sort of heavyweight actually existed. His like movement, his speed, his timing, his aggression, it was phenomenal. So based on that, Fury
2-0.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm not prepared to say that in any form that's going to come back to me.
Right, hopefully we can watch at least one of those together anyway.
That'd be phenomenal.
Nigel, thanks, mate. Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for your time and for your honesty and inspiration and all of those things, mate.
Absolute pleasure, man. Awesome. Any time. And actually, I'd really like to give you a couple of other people you should speak to, because I think
definitely
you'd find particularly stateside, you'd also get a different perspective. It's one thing hearing me talking about it, but you know, I think it'd be really great for you to speak to an actual real African American about how they feel about this. Could be quite fun.
Yeah. Oh, love to, definitely. All right, thanks, mate. We'll sort that out, and I'll speak to you soon.
All right, take care, mate. Thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
See you later. Bye.
Okay, thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound, from creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts. They're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again, until next time.